The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
Welcome again, everybody, and welcome to you, Eric. Really nice to have you here. Eric Storley, some of you know, I'm sure. I see a lot of people from the University Center for Spirituality and Healing, where Eric's been teaching for a while. But many of us, myself included, were inspired by Suzuki Roshi's book whenever we got started or found it. But Eric was one of those few people who was actually there in the early 60s in the Bay Area and got to practice with Suzuki Roshi for a number of years, both at the Zen Center in San Francisco, but also their retreat center, Tassajara, south of the cities. There he met Katagiri Roshi and was one of the people who inspired Katagiri Roshi to come to the Twin Cities and start the Minnesota Zen Center in the early 70s after Suzuki Roshi had died. And Eric was a student of Katagiri Roshi for a number of years. And he's written a book. I noticed it wasn't in the in your bio here. Can you remind me of the title of the book?
Nothing on My Mind.
Nothing on My Mind, which is both a wonderful book about practice, a person's practice and the development of practice, but also just a great history of that whole scene, California, Berkeley, in the 60s and the early years with Suzuki Roshi. So I recommend it. So thanks again, Eric, for coming. Tonight's talk is Touching Bedrock. There's more to it. The most important thing, touching bedrock. Thank you, Eric.
Well, thank you for having me. A pleasure to be here. About a year ago, Rick Okada, who did a lot of the architectural work for Common Ground, who's an old friend, and we meditate together and drink tea together. He tries to teach my wife and I some Tai Chi. Offered to give us the tour of the new building, and so we came and met Mark, and that led to this invitation to talk to you. And it was wonderful to see this building. And I don't remember the old restaurant that it once was. I remember the corner. Many years ago, I drank at the Hexagon Bar. I don't know what it's like now. But this is, a fantastic thing happening in the United States. When I went to Berkeley in 1962 to enter the graduate program in English, and as I thought, become a medievalist focusing on Chaucer and Piers Plowman and Gawain and the Green Knight and the Arthurian legends and so forth, there was nothing like this in the Twin Cities or Minnesota. There were certainly a few little groups, cultural Buddhist groups, so I'm sure there were some few Chinese and Japanese living here, but there was no connection necessarily with a practice with Caucasians, or shall we say non-Asians. So here we are, 62, so we're almost over 40 years, two generations now have developed practices that would lead us to a center like this, or the half dozen centers or more now in the Twin Cities where we could actually sit together for half an hour in wonderful silence. So it's remarkable. And I'm grateful for that. So it was very sweet just to sit together. Although a little disconcerting because in the Soto Zen tradition that I was trained in, everybody faces the wall. So I felt suddenly exposed up here with everybody looking at me. I better really have good posture. And then, of course, course, halfway through, I felt the classic concert hall tickle in my throat, you know, where you know that it's a moment of silence and the orchestra's breathing, and, but no, I'm going to cough, so. But very sweet. I see some people from the university here. Cass is here, and Mara and Terry, who instructed me in MBSR a few years ago, and then we made a credit offering to offer university students. And since we're all here, Cass, would you just mention the center? Well, you're looking a bit caught here. But anyway, a number of us are working at the University Center for Spirituality and Healing to bring, among many other things, what I might call Asian arts, yoga, meditation, mindfulness, to the university. And the university has been groundbreaking in actually creating this kind of in the academic health center, and one of the first institutions to really embrace these things, make them available to the community, make create credit offerings so students can be exposed to this and work with these these arts or yogas without having to become Buddhist or become Hindu or worry about issues of religion. So I routinely now I'll have some Muslim students in my classes, which is unusual. One young woman said to me, well, I could never go to a meditation center, but I can take a credit class in mindfulness. So that remarkable developments now in this country that brings this these possibilities here. As Mark mentioned, I went to Berkeley. I thought I was going to be a medievalist. I ended up writing a dissertation back in Minnesota on Zen and Puritanism. Look, so that was a big switch. And I was in the Bay Area 4 years, 1 year living at the Page Street Zen Center the year that Suzuki died, and then 3 years at Cal at Berkeley. And in the early 70s, Katagiri Roshi agreed to come to Minnesota, and with the help of many people, among them Robert Persig and his wife, with the proceeds from Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, we bought the building on Lake Calhoun, which is still there, and my old friend Tim Burkett is the head teacher there. So I think of that as the mothership where, you know, it spawned, although I realize that this is not in the Soto Zen tradition or the Mahayana tradition, but that was kind of the first little planting. And initially, the Japanese, many of the Japanese Zen practitioners considered Zen in America a very unlikely thing. There was one comment by one of the Zen teachers that bringing Zen to America would be like uprooting a flower, holding the root against a rock, and waiting for it to take root. So there's certainly truth to that, because all of these practices are deeply embedded culturally in the Asian countries and cultures. So a lot of, you know, kind of breaking off many edges and things that don't apply to us had to happen. Certainly it happened in the Soto Zen tradition. For example, having retreats with both men and women. And that wouldn't happen in a normal Soto Zen monastery or nunnery. So that's a huge change. which makes it possible to do this in this country. To give you just one other piece of my history, I brought a book that probably was might be considered the beginning of my lineage. It's called The Dharma Bums by Jack Kerouac. So at age 22 in 1962, I was reading the Beatniks. I was reading Kerouac, Ginsberg, Snyder, who were getting intrigued with Buddhism. So then you end up with 1958, a very popular book called The Dharma Bums. And it's dedicated to Hanshan, the kind of crazy, eccentric Japanese or Chinese Buddhist hermit. So the Beatniks were much in love with Buddhism, Hinduism, and also very naive. But this was incredibly attractive in the early 60s. And Ginsberg, Snyder, and company were 15 years older than I was, and still are. In fact, Ginsberg's gone. I think Snyder's doing well. Kerouac was gone long ago. But I'll just read you the blurb. So this gives you a sense of this is kind of the history. We're here in part because of this history. Before this, there was interest in Buddhism and Hinduism. Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson were reading in Hinduism and Buddhism. There were people like someone help me. The autobiography of a yogi. Paramahansa Yogananda. Yes. So there was stuff like that happening, but that was in Hollywood or in New York. But we young beatniks, beatnik wannabes, were following in this trail. This is the book that turned on the psychedelic generation. A barrier-smashing novel about two rebels on a wild march for experience, from Frisco's swinging bars to the top of the snow-capped Sierras, etc., etc. So, and then by the 70s it all got very strict and a little more settled down. And here we are. So I ran into Terry walking around the lake with my granddaughter, and she said, "What's this touching bedrock? There is no bedrock." And I thought, "Well, I knew someone was going to get me on that." But of course, at some basic level, yeah, that's what in the mind-only doctrine of Zen is called shunyata. Emptiness, void, nothingness. And yet, here's the bedrock, sitting, just meditation. That's the bedrock. And ever since, amazingly, since 64, when I met Suzuki and began practicing, this has been my bedrock. And I always think of the story of the Buddha being afflicted by Mara, the evil one, as he sat under the bow tree, trying to drive him off his meditation seat. And we've all, many times, had Mara or some form trying to drive us off our meditation seat. It could be the phone ringing, could be depression, it could be any number of things. Boredom, or this isn't working, or it's beautiful outside, or fear. So Mara's first effort against the Buddha was, of course, the dancing girls. you know, you're a man, desire, come on, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Well, here it was, you know, the Dharma bus. And that didn't work. And then Mara came with volcanoes, hurricanes, warriors, armies, and that apparently bothered the Buddha, so he touched the ground with his fingertips. The old story says of his right hand. And the earth thundered its witness. You're cool. You get to sit here. You belong. Don't move. This is your place. So that's our bedrock. We can sit here on the earth. We can just be here and digest our struggles. And as Katagiri Roshi, who founded the Zen Center, used to say, we're always trying to escape our problems. And this sitting is the one place I know where you really have to confront. I'm not dismissing therapy. My wife is a therapist. I'm not dismissing all sorts of other modalities. But at least for me, the final step, or not step, but just the place I can be grounded is here in sitting. And then the world is out there, and I teach. I'm a parent, husband, grandparent, friend, part of the community. So all of that can flow out and back in. So, Terry, I don't know if that convinces you, but but so yes, this bedrock of Zen sitting, of Shikantaza, just plain sitting. No agenda, no assignment, just here. So I thought I would say a little bit about Dogen, who founded the Soto Zen sect, a Japanese monk from the 13th century, who went to China, and this was a time when Buddhist practice had become more ceremonial. The effort in Chinese Zen was to get back to sitting, just plain sitting. Enough of ceremony, enough of ritual, enough of philosophy. We need to sit. The Buddha sat, we better sit. So, in the first lecture that Dogen gave when he came back from China, he struggled with this question, why bother to sit? Why practice? After all, the teaching is that the Dharma, the Buddha nature, is everywhere, all-pervading. Why do we have to do something about it? This should be taken care of already. If, in fact, all beings are Buddha, everything is manifesting the Dharma. So this is a text called Fukan Zazengi, a lecture to monks, which was taken down somehow, not with a tape recorder, but shorthand, I presume. The way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent upon practice and realization? Why should I have to meditate? Why should I have to practice? The Dharma vehicle is utterly free and untrammeled. What need is there for our concentrated effort? Indeed, the whole body is far beyond the world's dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from you, right where you are. What use is there going off here and there to practice? So that's the theory, right? It's right here. We're already there. Everything is in its ultimate perfection. So, what's boogie? Why? Why sit in a meditation hall? Why do practices? And yet, if there is the slightest discrepancy, the way is as distant as heaven from earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. So Dogen answers himself simply from the experience we all have. Well, I'm not feeling so good right now. I'm not feeling so perfect. So what's wrong? And then he simply goes on to explain how to take the posture, how to physically sit. And then he says, once you have adjusted yourself into this posture, take a deep breath, inhale, exhale, rock your body to the right and left, which you'll still see happening at the beginning of meditation and any Soto practice. Settle into a steady, unmoving, sitting position. Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. So, not much technique there, just, well, that was very puzzling. And the teaching that came from Suzuki and Katagiri was simply staying with the breath. That's all. Oh, Katagiri gave me a koan occasionally, but that wasn't his practice. The practice was and is simply silent illumination. Simply be here, sit down and shut up. But that's not very attractive. And so Dogen supplements that kind of very bare attention, being in the naked moment practice, with a lot of wonderful poetic metaphor and story that's inspiring. So in some sense, all I can do here, sitting here, is perhaps be encouraging. You know, courage, my heart, your hearts, maybe something I say is encouraging. On the one hand, the Buddha's teaching is beautifully logical. You think of the Four Noble Truths. It's essentially a physician's analysis. We come to the Buddha, we, the patient, and we say, I'm not feeling so good. Ah, you're suffering, you know. What's hurting? Everything. Oh, okay. Well, let's look into this. Okay, well, I see the cause of this problem. You're greedy all the time. You're craving. You're desiring. You're never, whatever moment you're in, you're always on tiptoe trying to get to the next one because this one isn't good enough. That's craving. You know, the definition of suffering is when the given moment you're in is inadequate and you want to get to the next one quicker. So you're divided. That's tension. That's pain. Well, what's the prognosis, says the patient? Is there any hope? Oh, yeah. Third noble truth. Yeah, there's hope. Oh, good. What's the medicine? Oh, just the Eightfold Path. That's the medicine. That's the cure. And then essentially we get something that in its own way is very simple. Behave well, don't harm others. Be very attentive, number 7, be very attentive, be very mindful. Watch what's happening in your mind and all around you. And meditate. Just be here. Just be here. So, beautiful logic, psychology, no mysticism, nothing. No gods, demons, just, okay, here's the medicine. But it's very bare. It's perhaps not that encouraging. So, what's wonderful about Dogen, and if you ever get a chance, or if you're interested, get the Waddell and Abe translation, The Heart of Dogen's Shobo Genzo. Then he tries to describe this experience of just plain sitting, of non-thinking, in ways that give us a sense of what this might be. And perhaps the most famous one, which I suspect some of you have read, oh, before I go there, there's another wonderful statement attributed to the Buddha of the limitations of words in teaching. So, the Buddha said, for 50 years, from beginning to end, oh wait, I've got to skip down here. For 50 years, from beginning to end, I've preached not a single word. And he held out a flower, and that brought a smile to Kashyapa's lips, etc. Then he went on to say, my preaching of the Dharma for more than 50 years may be likened to saying there is something in your hand in order to bring near a small child you want to take in your arms. My 50 years and more of Dharma preaching have been like a beckoning. That is why the Dharma I transmit is like the taking up of a child to my breast. So all of this fancy teaching, the Four Noble Truths and 10,000 Sutras, are simply a trick. So I bring my hand out and I say to the small child, I have something. I have something here. And then the child comes and I can embrace it. And fold it. And it's empty. But then there's still 10,000 sutras and teachings and so on and so forth. But that's very lovely, you know. The hand is empty. So the words are not that important. And yet they are. And that's why we're here, to talk. But then we could sit together. But anyway, here's the most famous expression of Dogen's on this experience of bedrock, of just sitting. And this is from the Genjo Koan, his most beautiful and puzzling work. The attainment of enlightenment is like the moon reflected on the water. The moon does not get wet, and the surface of the water is not broken. For all the breadth and vastness of its light, the moon comes to rest in a small patch of water. The whole moon and the sky in its entirety come to rest in a single dewdrop on a grass tip, a mere pinpoint of water. So unpack that a little bit. The attainment of enlightenment is like the moon reflected on the water. Well, we're the water. We're the water. And we can reflect the universe. We can reflect the moon. We can. Each of us now in this room is reflecting the room and the 30 or 40 people here. So the mind is like a mirror that receives and reflects back. Receives and reflects back. The attainment of enlightenment is like the moon reflected on the water. The moon does not get wet, and the surface of the water is not broken. So there's a complete harmony there. For all the breadth and vastness of its light, the moon comes to rest in a small patch of water. So this universe is infinite. And yet, each of us is reflecting this infinity. The whole moon in the sky in its entirety come to rest in a single dewdrop on a grass tip, a mere pinpoint of water. So each of us is that tiny dewdrop, and yet, if we look closely, the whole moon and sky can be reflected in the dewdrop. Enlightenment does not destroy man any more, man and woman any more, than the moon makes a hole on the surface of the water. Human beings do not obstruct enlightenment any more than the drop of dew obstructs the moon or the heavens. The depth of the one will be the measure of the other's height. So the tiny drop of dew and the infinite sky, in some sense, measure each other and reflect each other. From the tiniest to the most vast. As for the time, the quickness or slowness of enlightenment's coming, you must carefully scrutinize the quantity of the water, survey the extent of the moon and the sky. So, here Dogen's looking at our hurried nature. So we start practicing meditation, and the question is, well, when will I be enlightened? I mean, I'm a busy person. So I can't, you know, I'll give this, and you know, I mean, I was appalled when I read some of the old Zen stories where it took 20 years before the teacher acknowledged the student. I thought, well, we can, come on. This is America, we can speed this up. But this is human nature. We all want, if we're going to do this, when are we going to get the results? You know, when will I be fixed? When is the cure? So, Dogen, of course, is just being cagey here. As for the time, the quickness or slowness of enlightenment's coming, you must carefully scrutinize the quantity of the water. Well, let's see, the oceans are quite large. Survey the extent of the moon and the sky. So he's essentially saying, forget it. Don't worry about a timetable. There is no timetable. So that, in fact, his teaching and the teaching in the Soto tradition primarily, also in the Rinzai, but certainly in the Soto, is that there is no such thing as practice as differentiated from enlightenment. There is something that should be called practice enlightenment. Practice enlightenment. So going back to that dilemma, if all beings are enlightened or have the Buddha nature, why should I practice? Dogen cuts through that paradox simply by saying, it's both. If you're not practicing, you're not enlightened. We are enlightened, and we can know it through practice. paradox. Language breaks down here. It's the kind of paradox of asking, is this finger separate? Yes, but sever it from my body, is it still a finger? Well, yes and no. So there's the issue of oneness of all things, paradoxically, not eliminating the difference of things. So there's unity and difference both, a problem, logical problem. And my work in looking at Christianity was a similar problem. If God is all-knowing and the universe is perfected by the creation of God, how can I possibly earn my way into heaven? And this is where Luther comes in and says, only by grace. It's a free gift of God if you're going to get to heaven. You can't earn it by giving alms or buying indulgences or going through certain ceremonies. It's only a gift. Well, how do I earn the gift? You can't earn the gift. It's infinite. It's too big. Well, then why should I behave properly? Because if you don't, you'll go to hell. Well, why should I go to hell if I... And the bottom line is, you better do both. You know, no guarantees. It's a free gift. But if you behave badly, you're just demonstrating that you're not going to get the gift. So that paradox intrigued me in Christian thought. And it's here in Dogen from the very beginning. Now, at the end of the Genjo Koan, he resolves it with a story. As Zen Master Pao Che of Mount Mayu was fanning himself, a monk came up and said, the nature of the wind is constancy. So here we have an image of ancient China. It's a hot day. They're in the Zendo or they're outside. And no air conditioning. So the master is using his fan or his whisk. And the monk approaches and says, the nature of the wind is constancy. Code for all beings are enlightened. The Buddha is everywhere. In Hinduism, the Brahman, there is nothing that is not it. So this finger is the Buddha, the table is the Buddha, every thought in my head is the Buddha, all of our clothing is the Buddha, air is the Buddha, gravity, everything, everything. The nature of the wind is constancy. There is no place it does not reach. Why do you use a fan? Why do you use a fan? Why are you practicing this, wiggling this thing when the wind is everywhere? Why meditate? Why meditate? Now, Dogen was very upset by people who claimed to be practicers or claimed to be Buddhist monks who didn't practice. I just had a student ask me at the university about some adept who explained to her that he never meditated anymore because he was too advanced. You know, he'd caught the brass ring, and so he was done. And, you know, okay, good. So Pao Che answered, you only know the nature of the wind as constancy. You haven't yet grasped the meaning of its reaching every place. Now, when Katagiri Roshi talked about this story, and he read this, Pao Che answered, you only know the nature of the wind as constancy. It cracked him up. He said, oh, well, the monk didn't know that either, but Pao Che is being nice to him. So you haven't yet grasped the meaning of its reaching every place. What is the meaning of its reaching every place? Asked the monk. The master only fanned himself. And the monk bowed. So, you know, this is like the Buddha's Aryan noble silences. So someone would approach the Buddha with a theoretical, philosophical question about afterlife, or where does the arhat go upon his death? And his response might just be, let's say, silence. Or this is not a question that edifies. You can ask that question for the rest of your life and you'll still suffer. So don't you remember the prescription I wrote for you? You can work with that, the Eightfold Path. Verification of the Buddha Dharma, the authentic transmission of the vital way, is like this. To say that one should not use a fan because the wind is constant, that there will be a wind even when one does not use a fan, fails to understand both constancy and the nature of the wind. It is because the nature of the wind is constancy that the wind of the house of Buddhism reveals the great earth's golden presence and ripens the sweet milk of the long rivers. So it's true, isn't it? The wind is filling this room, and yet if we need to cool our face, we have to practice, we have to move it. And then it manifests itself as a cooling breeze. So let's just look back at one other quote. So I skipped away from think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. And then the next paragraph, trying to describe the essential art of Zazen, Dogen says, the Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It is simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss. It is the practice hyphen realization of totally culminated enlightenment. It is in things as they are in suchness. No traps or snares can ever reach it. Once its heart is grasped, you are like the dragon when he reaches the water, like the tiger when he enters the mountain. So I like that. I think we all want to be the dragon reaching the water, the tiger entering the mountain. But then we just have to sit down. And when things want to push us off our seat, as they often do, just touch the earth. Let the earth assure you that you have a perfect right to be right here. And probably that's the best thing you could do for the next 40 minutes. Be right there. Be right there. Any comments, questions, observations? Sorry to go on so long. I love Dogen, but we're all just getting restless for the hexagon. So it's good, you know, it's the same teaching that we get in the Sermon on the Mount. You can let your greed and craving go. Things will be fine. Let the morrow take care of the evils of the morrow. Don't worry so much about fine clothing, food, cars, careers. Not that we don't have to do all that. relax. Sink into the moment. Enjoy the fact that we're here, alive and awake. So as Suzuki used to say again and again, the mind is entirely sufficient unto itself. The mind is sufficient. That mind that can reflect the universe freely. It's a gift. Just a gift coming in. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, early on you were mentioning a bit about, you know, touching the bedrock and Zazen and Shikun Paza. You kind of included a few things all in the same sentence. And I was just, I guess it was my understanding that there's a little bit more of a difference between Zazen and Shikun Paza. Is that true? I thought, well, one was kind of meditation with an object, and one.
Well, Shikun Paza, it can be translated just plain sitting. Just plain sitting. Silent illumination. No object. Whereas Zazen, I think we could include, I'm doing Zazen, I'm working on a koan. What is the sound of one hand clapping? So I'm doing my Zazen, and I'm struggling with the problem of what is the sound of one hand. So yeah. But I get sloppier the older I get. So. But I tell my students when I'm at the university, I'm teaching the meditation of no assignment. No assignment. No koans, no techniques. But if you're distracted, find the breath, because that's always here. It belongs to you. As Katagiri used to say, you own your body and mind. You don't have to write a check. You don't have to get a mantra. You know, it's right here. So if you're distracted, you can always find the breath, which is always in this moment. And then open, kind of like the hand can open. But then I warn the students not to tell their legislators I'm teaching them to do nothing. Because we don't want funding cut off. We're supposed to be driving forward, spinning the economy with these students. But good point. Thanks. Well, you're released. You don't have to think of a question. So, yeah.
So I'm curious about what how you experience the mindfulness-based stress reduction, since that seems like so much more elaborate than what we're talking about tonight.
Well, you know, I've often thought that if I'd had contact with Kabat-Zinn before the Soto Zen sect, I would have been much more attracted to that, because it didn't. Kabat-Zinn had discarded much of the ceremonial and cultural stuff. Much more accessible. But you know, starting back in the 70s, I went to Swami Rama, learned some yoga. So I'm not rejecting any of these things. But as a core meditative practice, I simply want people to finally understand that they can just let it all go. There's no technique in particular that's required, and it's a release. It's a release. It's an effort. It's a powerful effort of attention and intention, but so the yoga is very helpful. Kabat-Zinn brings in some of the best of Western counseling and psychology, so that it's been westernized with these practices that were generally, certainly the contemplation began to get lost during the Renaissance when the Western world turned to science. And yoga was never in the Western world. So I think it's a wonderful, skillful means to bring this into an American world and have it. I think of the meditation as at the core of that mindfulness practice. Yeah.
It seems to be a common experience when one sits that the mind just runs off and chases all kinds of awareness.
Yeah.
In your practice of just sitting and being, do you allow the mind in just to go? Do you spend part of your time thinking about what you have to do tomorrow? Or do you make an effort to come back to just sitting right here? Or are you just allowing the mind to go?
I'll do both. I'm lazy. So, but, you know, when I see that wandering, then I invite the mind back. Try to expand from that narrow focus. Sure, again and again and again. Yeah. But at the same time, as Dogen says in the passage we didn't get to, every thought, even a distracting thought, is the Buddha. Or in that case, he's using the metaphor of the bright pearl. Everything in the universe is a bright pearl. All of us are the bright pearl. Every distracting thought is the bright pearl. So there's Zen... often is suspicious of the notion that we're just going to blank out the mind. No. Thoughts are like waves. They come, they go. Let's not get too cranked about it. Because that also is adding on another level of crankiness. So, but yeah, Paul, I mean, that's the thing about practice realization. If the effort ceases, you're not meditating. Right? So, sure, I've slept through many sittings, but then you wake up to that and start fanning again, trying to follow the doctor's prescription. Yeah.
Do you think it really put the same concise form? So much of what you said talks about the relationship with the mind, with the moment, if I put it that way. And, you know, when I'm meditating, maybe it's kind of a perfectionistic angle, I kind of look for that total emptiness of no mind activity. And I think I realize the fallacy of that, and then listening to what you say seems to underscore that the mind is not to be ignored, because it is integral to us, so it can't be ignored. But at the same token, I don't know any other way to describe it, it's sort of like a tour guide, where it's there to impart information, but at the end of the day, it's up for us to have that relationship with wherever we are, as opposed to all the information that's being dumped upon us. And it seems to me your story about the Buddha picking up the flower and smiling ultimately affirms that, because it's like you get down to that duality point of, can words and mind explain it in this? And he says, by his actions, he says, it's just the moment, it's just what you're experiencing. So I know, it's kind of sort of going down, it's really an interesting, like you say, a paradox. It's a duality that, mind just can't be dismissed, because it is part of our total awareness of all this.
Yeah.
So I guess you got to take the loss with it.
Yeah. Yeah, the mind is the bright pearl. The distractions are the bright pearl. And the fact that we get hungry and have to eat is part of the bright pearl. So it's very dualistic, and we're often moving into the good-bad. Well, if I just didn't have to do this, then I'd be undistracted, or but it's similar to the paradoxical nature of an art. If I'm a musician or an artist, I may work 20 years to become able to play a Beethoven piano concerto, and to the audience it's effortless. But we know that it took years of effort for that effort to blossom into effortlessness. So this, in this sitting practice, you know, there are wonderful moments when it blossoms into release and effortlessness. And then waves come, and in some very deep ways, like the Pacific Ocean, 7 miles deep, we can hold all that and be with it and not get too cranked. Yeah.
Hi, my name is April.
Hi.
I've only been coming here for about a month, and I'm a self-tenor musician, I'm a singer. And I just wanted to share something that occurred in this actually past week. I've had a very stressful week, and what you said about having to, as a musician, you practice and technique forms as years go by, and eventually it gets easier. Well, because I've been meditating for about the past month, and I came across this 1 week of high stress, I found that because I had a new space in my mind, that I almost had to rethink how I was within my stress, like how I even related to it. And my coworkers were actually able to even designate that. But what I'm more curious about, since you say technique that really resonates with me as a musician, how often do you practice?
Well, it's variable. I'd say from 0 to 2 hours a day. 0 to 2 hours a day. Today was zero because my wife and I was thinking about what to say, and then we went and babysat a 6-month-old grandchild who seems to run the show.
May I also say that I was on...
Well, let me add, retreats, you know, then there are opportunities to do more intensive.
More intensive meditation. But because I'm also a singer, I feel the same kind of intensity in meditation that I do on stage in a very similar way, except I figured out that it's my ego and will that is forcing that focus while on stage compared to when I'm sitting. And that was a realization that I had this week. Because I couldn't figure that out, how I found that same kind of center and stillness set on stage, except I had some fear and a lot of other crap about what could go wrong that I don't feel in the sitting.
Mm-hmm. Well, the meditation opens up some room to see new things about yourself as a singer and as a person. So in some ways we develop a new relationship to thought and emotion. Usually we're being pushed by, Suzuki Roshi used to say, the mind is a bully. Meaning the mind, you know, hurry up, get this done. And the sitting is a way of saying, ah, I'm here. Thank you for trying to rush me, but I think I won't be rushed. Well, and thank you all for coming and, as Click and Clack say, wasting a perfectly good hour. So, it was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Eric, for coming. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.